through personal experience. As I've mentioned elsewhere, by far one of the most common arguments I used to hear from people about why I should sign up for Facebook is that there might be some benefit I didn't even know about that I might be missing. You never know, maybe you'll find this to be useful. Has got to be one of the worst product pitches ever devised. But in the peculiar context of the digital attention economy, it makes a lot of sense to people. An atmosphere of vagueness leads people to sign into the service with no particular purpose in mind, which, of course, makes them easier targets for the attention engineer's clever hooks and exploits, leading to the staggering amounts of usage time that Facebook needs to sustain its equally staggering $500 billion valuation. Which brings us back to Facebook's folly. The reason why Ginsburg and Burke's article should concern their employer is because it punctures the myth of Facebook as a foundational technology that everyone should just use in some generic sense. By assessing different ways to engage with Facebook, one by one, identifying which seem more positive than others, Ginsburg and Burke are encouraging people to think critically about what exactly they want to get out of this service. This mindset is potentially disastrous for the company. To see why, try the following experiment. Assuming that you use Facebook, list the most important things it provides you, the particular activities that you would really miss if you were forced to stop using the service altogether. Now imagine that Facebook started charging you by the minute. How much time would you really need to spend in the typical week to keep up with your list of important Facebook activities? For most people, the answer is surprisingly small, somewhere around 20 to 30 minutes. The average Facebook user, by contrast, spends around 350 minutes per week on this company's services. If we take the 50 minutes per day cited previously and multiply it by the 7 days in a week, this means that if you were careful, you would be using these services somewhere around 11 to 17 times less than average. If everyone started thinking about their use in similarly utilitarian terms, the terms promoted by Ginsburg and Burke, the amount of eyeball minutes Facebook has available to sell to advertisers would drop by more than an order of magnitude, creating a massive hit to their bottom line. Investors would revolt. In recent years, even single-digit reductions to Facebook quarterly earnings have stoked Wall Street anxiety, and the company would likely not survive with anything near its current form. Critical use is a critical problem for the digital attention economy. Understanding the fragile attention economics that support companies like Facebook helps reveal an important strategy for succeeding with digital minimalism. The Ginsburg and Burke article highlights two radically different ways to think about using a service like Facebook. The big companies want use to be a simple binary condition. Either you engage with their foundational technology, or you're a weirdo. By contrast, the type of use these companies perhaps most fear is the Ginsburg and Burke definition, which sees these products as offering a variety of different free services that you can carefully sift through and use in a manner that optimizes the value you receive. This latter type of use is pure digital minimalism, but it's also difficult to successfully put into action. One of the reasons I detailed the specific financial numbers involved in the digital attention economy is to emphasize the sheer volume of resources these companies can deploy to push you away from the targeted use of Ginsburg and Burke and toward the more open-ended wandering their business model depends on. The lopsidedness of this battle is a big part of the reason I never messed around with any of these services in the first place. To repeat a line from the New Yorker writer George Packer, Twitter scares me, not because I'm morally superior to it, but because I don't think I could handle it. I'm afraid I'd end up letting my son go hungry. If you must use these services, however, and you hope to do so without ceding autonomy over your time and attention, it's crucial to understand that this is not a casual decision. You're instead waging a David and Goliath battle against institutions that are both impossibly rich and intent on using this wealth to stop you from winning. Put another way, to approach attention economy services with the intentionality proposed by Ginsburg and Burke is not a common sense adjustment to your digital habits, but is instead better understood as a bold act of resistance. Fortunately, if you take this path, you'll not be alone. My research on digital minimalism has revealed the existence of a loosely organized attention resistance movement, made up of individuals who combine high-tech tools with disciplined operating procedures to conduct surgical strikes on popular attention economy services, dropping in to extract value and then slipping away before the attention traps set by these companies can spring shut. The remainder of this chapter, which is entirely dedicated to concrete advice, will bring you inside the tactics innovated by this resistance movement. The practices that follow each focus on a different category of these tactics. All of them have proved successful in shunting aside relentless efforts to capture your attention. Perhaps more important than the details of these practices is the mindset they embody. If your personal brand of digital minimalism requires engagement with services like social media or breaking news sites, it's important to approach these activities with a sense of zero-sum antagonism. You want something valuable from their networks, and they want to undermine your autonomy. To come out on the winning side of this battle requires both preparation and a ruthless commitment to avoiding exploitation. Vive la résistance. Practice. Delete social media from your phone. Something big happened to Facebook starting around 2012. In March of that year, they began, for the first time, to show ads on the mobile version of their service. By October, 14% of the company's ad revenue came from mobile ads, making it into a small but nicely profitable piece of Mark Zuckerberg's growing empire. Then it took off. By the spring of 2014, Facebook reported that 62% of its revenue came from mobile, leading the technology website The Verge to declare, "Facebook is a mobile company now." This statement has continued to prove accurate. By 2017, mobile ad revenue rose to 88% of their earnings and is still climbing. These Facebook statistics underscore a trend true of social media more generally. Mobile pays the bills. This reality has important implications for the attention resistance. It emphasizes that the smartphone versions of these services are much more adept at hijacking your attention than the versions accessed through a web browser on your laptop or desktop computer. This difference is due in part to the ubiquitous nature of smartphones. Because you always have the phone with you, every occasion becomes an opportunity to check your feeds. Before the mobile revolution, services like Facebook could only monetize your attention during periods when you happened to be sitting at your computer. There's also, however, a more ominous feedback loop at play. As more people began to access social media services on their smartphones, the attention engineers at these companies invested more resources into making their mobile apps stickier. As discussed in the first part of this book, some of these engineers' most ingenious attention traps, including the slot machine action of swiping down to refresh a feed or alarm red notification badges, are mobile-only innovations. Pulling together these pieces of evidence points to a clear conclusion. If you're going to use social media, stay far away from the mobile versions of these services, as these pose a significantly bigger risk to your time and attention. This practice, in other words, suggests that you remove all social media apps from your phone. You don't have to quit these services, you just have to quit accessing them on the go. This strategy is classic digital minimalism. By removing your ability to access social media at any moment, you reduce its ability to become a crutch deployed to distract you from bigger voids in your life. At the same time, you're not necessarily abandoning these services. By allowing yourself access, albeit less convenient, through a web browser, you preserve your ability to use specific features that you identify as important to your life, but on your own terms. I started informally offering this advice soon after my last book, Deep Work, was released in early 2016. At the time, a lot of readers were nervous about my minimalist suggestion to quit social media services that didn't provide more benefits than harms. Accordingly, I began to suggest that they take the apps off their phones as a first step. Two things struck me about the feedback that began to trickle in. First, a non-trivial percentage of people who deleted the apps discovered that they essentially stopped using social media altogether. Even the small extra barrier of needing to log into a computer was enough to prevent them from making the effort, revealing, often to their admitted surprise, that services they claimed were indispensable were in reality providing nothing more than convenient hits of distraction. The second thing I noticed was that for people who did continue to use social media on their computers, their relationship to these services transformed. They began to sign in for specific, high-value purposes, and only do so every once in a while. Facebook use, for example, dropped down toward one or two checks a week for many of my readers who took the app off of their phone. For them, social media became one tool among many they sometimes use, and stopped acting as an omnipresent drain on their attention. For these reasons, this advice likely frightens social media companies. They're happy to argue about the importance of their services or give examples of the good things they have provided society, but the one thing they definitely don't want you to notice is that the only really good reason to be accessing these services on your phone is to ensure companies like Facebook continue to enjoy steady quarterly growth. Practice. Turn your devices into single-purpose computers. In 2008, Fred Stutzman was a graduate student at the University of North Carolina, working on a doctoral dissertation about the role of new tools like social media to aid life transitions, such as heading off to college. Perhaps ironically, given the topic of his research, Stutzman struggled with this work because his internet-connected laptop offered too many enticing distractions. His solution was to start writing at a nearby coffee shop. This plan worked well until the building next to the coffee shop got Wi-Fi. Frustrated by his inability to escape the attractions of the internet, Stutzman programmed his own tool to block the network connections on his computer for set amounts of time. He called it, appropriately enough, Freedom. Stutzman posted the tool online, where it soon began to gather a cult following. Realizing that he was onto something, he shelved his academic career to focus on the software full-time. In the years that followed, the tool became more sophisticated. Instead of simply deactivating the internet, you can now use it to block custom lists of distracting websites and applications, and set up regular schedules that activate this blocking automatically. It also works across all of your devices, allowing a single click from your Freedom dashboard to activate blocking across your computers, phones, and tablets. The tool has since been adopted by over 500,000 users, including, notably, the novelist Zadie Smith, who thanked Freedom by name in the acknowledgments of her critically acclaimed 2012 bestseller, N.W., crediting the software for creating the time needed for her to finish the manuscript. Smith is not alone. Freedom's internal research reveals that its users gain, on average, 2.5 hours of productive time per day. Despite the effectiveness of Freedom and other similarly popular blocking tools, such as self-control, its role in human-computer interaction is often misunderstood. Consider, for example, the following quote from a profile of Stutzman that appeared in Science. There's an even deeper irony, and also a retro element, in the idea of taking a powerful productivity machine like a modern laptop computer and shutting down some of its core functions in order to increase productivity. This sentiment, that temporarily blocking features of a general-purpose computer reduces its potential, is common for skeptics of tools like Freedom. It's also flawed. It represents a misunderstanding of computation and productivity that benefits the large digital attention economy conglomerates much more than the individual users that they exploit. To understand my previous claim, some brief history is needed. Electromechanical machines that performed useful tasks were around before electronic computers. Many people forget, for example, that IBM was selling automatic tabulating machines to the U.S. Census Bureau as early as the 1890s. Part of what made computers so revolutionary was that they were general purpose. The same machine could be programmed to perform many different tasks. This approach was a huge improvement over constructing separate machines for each computational application, which is why computing technology ended up transforming the 20th century economy. The personal computer revolution that began in the 1980s carried this message of general-purpose productivity to individuals. An early print ad for the Apple II, for example, tells the story of a California store owner who uses his computer during the week to chart sales, then, during the weekends, totes it home to work on family finances with his wife. The idea that one machine could perform many different tasks was a key selling point. It's this mindset that general purpose equals productivity that leads people to cast a skeptical eye on tools like Freedom that remove options from your computing experience. The problem with this mindset, however, is that it jumbles the role of time in this type of productivity. What makes general purpose computing powerful is that you don't need separate devices for separate uses, not that it allows you to do multiple things at the same time. The California store owner from the earlier Apple ad used his computer to chart sales during the week and balance his checkbook on the weekends. He wasn't trying to do both simultaneously. Until recently, in the history of electronic computing, there was no reason to make this distinction, as personal computers could run only one user-facing program at a time, and there was a high cost for the user to switch from one application to another, often involving floppy disks and arcane commands. Today, of course, this has changed. As Stutzman learned while trying to write his doctoral dissertation, jumping from a word processor to a web browser requires only a single quick click. As many have discovered, the rapid switching between different applications tends to make the human's interaction with the computer less productive in terms of the quality and quantity of what is produced. With this in mind, there's nothing deeply ironic about taking a powerful productivity machine like a modern laptop computer and shutting down some of its core functions in order to increase productivity. It's instead quite natural once you recognize that the power of a general-purpose computer is in the total number of things it enables the user to do, not the total number of things it enables the user to do simultaneously. As I hinted earlier, a major beneficiary of the reluctance to shut down features on your computer is the digital attention economy. When you allow yourself, at all points, access to all that your general-purpose computers can offer, this list will include apps and websites engineered to hijack your attention. If you want to join the attention resistance, one of the most important things you can therefore do is follow Fred Stutzman's lead and transform your devices, laptops, tablets, phones, into computers that are general purpose in the long run, but are effectively single purpose in any given moment. This practice suggests that you use tools like Freedom to aggressively control when you allow yourself access to any website or app supported by a company that profits from your attention. I'm not talking about occasionally blocking some sites when working on a particularly hard project. I want you instead to think about these services as being blocked by default and made available to you on an intentional schedule. If you don't need social media for your work, for example, set up a schedule that blocks these sites and apps completely, with the exception of a few hours in the evening. If you do need a particular social media tool for work, say Twitter, then put aside a few blocks during the day when you can check it and leave it otherwise blocked. If there are certain infotainment sites that pull at your attention, for me, for example, baseball news about the Washington Nationals becomes impossibly appealing at times, follow this habit of leaving these sites blocked by default outside of specific windows. This practice of default blocking might at first seem overly aggressive, but what it's actually doing is bringing you back closer to the ideal of single-purpose computing that's much more compatible with our human attention systems. As with all of the advice in this chapter on the attention resistance, default blocking doesn't require you to abstain completely from the fruits of the digital attention economy. but forces you to approach them with more intention. It's a different way of thinking about your relationship with your computer, and one that is becoming increasingly necessary to remain a minimalist in our current age of distraction. Practice. Use social media like a professional. Jennifer Grigel is a social media pro. I don't mean this in the colloquial sense that they, Jennifer prefers the pronoun they, their to she, her, are good at using social media. I mean instead that Jennifer makes a living from an expert understanding of how to extract maximum value from these tools. During the rise of the Web 2.0 revolution, Jennifer was the social business and emerging media manager at State Street, a global financial services firm headquartered in Boston. Jennifer helped the company build an internal social network that enabled employees around the world to collaborate more efficiently, and established State Street's social listening program, allowing them to more carefully monitor references to State Street amid the noise of typical social media chatter, a task, Jennifer told me, that's made particularly challenging when your company's name is found on thousands of road signs across the country. From State Street, Jennifer moved to academia to become an assistant professor of communication, specializing in social media at the prestigious S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Jennifer now teaches a new generation of communication professionals how to maximize the power of social media. As you might expect, given this career history, Jennifer spends a fair amount of time using social media. What interests me more than the total amount of time that Jennifer spends on social media is the details of how they use it. If you ask Jennifer about these habits, as I did while researching this chapter, you'll discover that social media professionals like Jennifer approach these tools differently than the average user. They seek to extract large amounts of value for their professional and, to a lesser extent, personal lives, while avoiding much of the low-value distraction these services deploy to lure users into compulsive behaviors. Their disciplined professionalism, in other words, provides a great example for any digital minimalist looking to join the attention resistance. With this in mind, the remainder of this practice describes Jennifer's social media habits. You don't have to exactly mimic this particular mix of strategies, but this practice asks that you consider applying a similar level of intention and structure to your own engagement with these services. In summarizing Jennifer Grigel's social media habits, it's perhaps easiest to start with what Jennifer does not do. For one thing, Jennifer does not see social media as a particularly good source of entertainment. If you look at my Twitter feed, you won't see a lot of dog meme accounts. I already seem to get a lot of dog memes without needing to follow those accounts. Jennifer does use Instagram to follow accounts from a small number of communities related to their interests, a sufficiently narrow focus that it typically takes only a few minutes to browse all new posts since the last check. Jennifer is more suspicious, however, of the increasingly popular Instagram Stories feature, which lets you broadcast moments of your life. Jennifer describes it as reality TV starring your friends. This feature was introduced to increase the amount of content users generate, and therefore the amount of time they spend consuming this content. Jennifer's not biting. I don't know if there's too much value added in that feature. Jennifer also uses Facebook significantly less than the average user by maintaining a simple rule regarding the service. It's only for close friends and relatives, and for occasionally connecting with influencers. In the early years, I used to accept friend requests from anyone, they said. But I don't think we're really supposed to be connected to so many people so frequently. Jennifer now tries to keep friend engagement below the Dunbar number of 150, a theoretical limit for the number of people a human can successfully keep track of in their social circles. Jennifer still has over 1,000 contacts on Facebook. It is a difficult social act to formally unfriend someone, but tries to limit active engagement to a count below the Dunbar number. Jennifer uses the See First feature on their news feed and constraints on who gets messaged to help accomplish this engagement goal. Jennifer does not, for the most part, interact with professional colleagues on Facebook. If I need to connect with a colleague, I'll stop by their office or chat after work. Jennifer also thinks it's not the right platform to keep up with news, more soon on what Jennifer prefers for this purpose, or to debate issues, noting, the civility issues on that platform have gotten difficult. Instead, Jennifer logs on to Facebook maybe once every 4 days or so to see what's going on with their close friends and relatives. And that's it. The average user spends 35 minutes per day on Facebook's core functions, an amount that expands to around 50 minutes when you include the other social media services that Facebook owns. Jennifer typically spends less than an hour per week on the service. Checking in on your close social circles is a useful feature, but it's not one that requires a lot of time, a reality Facebook hopes you ignore. Where Jennifer dedicates most of their social media attention these days is Twitter, which they believe, at this current moment, to be the most important service for professionals. Jennifer's reasoning for this belief is that in most fields, many prominent people tweet. By tapping into their collective wisdom, you can stay up to speed on breaking news and novel ideas. Twitter also exposes you to people who might be valuable to add to your professional network. On many occasions during their career, Jennifer has benefited by reaching out through email to individuals that they've discovered through social media. This is how Jennifer and I first connected. Jennifer encountered my book through a recommendation, and then used social media to research my background, which uncovered the fact that we had come close to overlapping at MIT. Jennifer emailed me based on this foundation, sparking a friendly, ongoing conversation about social media. Drawing on their experience developing corporate social listening programs, Jennifer recognizes the overwhelming noisiness of most social media streams, and the care and discipline required to find useful signals in this noise. With this in mind, Jennifer maintains separate Twitter accounts for their academic interests and side interest in music. Jennifer played in bands for years. Within each account, Jennifer invests significant effort in selecting who they follow, focusing on high-quality thinkers or similar influencers in their topic area. In their academic account, for example, Jennifer follows a curated list of journalists, technologists, academics, and policymakers. Jennifer deploys Twitter as an early detection radar for trending news or ideas. This is particularly important for Jennifer's job, as they are often asked to give quotes or react to breaking news in their areas of expertise. When something catches Jennifer's attention on a social media timeline, they'll isolate it and dive deeper. In some cases, Jennifer will deploy a desktop tool called TweetDeck to aid this process. TweetDeck allows them to perform sophisticated searches to better understand Twitter trends. One important search function provided by this tool, for example, is thresholding. Here's how Jennifer explains it. I can search for a certain topic, say Black Lives Matter, and then set a threshold in TweetDeck that allows me to listen to this topic, but only see tweets with 50 likes or retweets. I can then refine this and say just show me the verified accounts. Thresholding is just one type of advanced search allowed by TweetDeck, and TweetDeck is just one tool among many that allow this style of more advanced filtering. For this purpose, big companies often rely on expensive software suites that integrate with their customer relationship management systems. The more important takeaway message here is the sophistication with which pros like Jennifer cut through the noise of social media to identify what information regarding a trend is worth their attention. There's real opportunity in social media to really benefit and grow, and some real negative sides to it as well, Jennifer told me. It's really like a tightrope. Most of us need to find a balance. Professionals like Jennifer highlight an effective way of achieving this balance. Approach social media as if you're the director of emerging media for your own life. Have a careful plan for how you use the different platforms, with the goal of maximizing good information and cutting out the waste. To a social media pro, the idea of endlessly surfing your feed in search of entertainment is a trap. These platforms have been designed to take more and more of your attention, an act of being used by these services instead of using them to your own advantage. If you internalize some of this attitude, your relationship with social media will become less tempestuous and more beneficial. Practice. Embrace slow media. Early in 2010, a trio of Germans with backgrounds in sociology, technology, and market research posted online a document titled Das Slow Media Manifest. The English translation reads The Slow Media Manifesto. The manifesto opens by noting that the first decade of the 21st century brought profound changes to the technological foundations of the media landscape. The second decade, the manifesto then proposes, should be dedicated to figuring out the appropriate reaction to these massive changes. Its suggestion? Embrace the concept of slow. Following the lead of the slow food movement, which promotes local food and traditional cuisine as an alternative to fast food, and which has become a major cultural force in Europe since its inception in Rome in the 1980s, the Slow Media Manifesto argues that in an age in which the digital attention economy is shoveling more and more clickbait toward us and fragmenting our focus into emotionally charged shards, the right response is to become more mindful in our media consumption. Slow media cannot be consumed casually, but provoke the full concentration of their users. Slow media measure themselves in production, appearance, and content against high standard of quality and stand out from their fast-paced and short-lived counterparts. This movement remains predominantly European. In the United States, by contrast, our response to these same issues has proved more puritanical. Whereas the Europeans suggest transforming the consumption of media into a high-quality experience, much like the slow food movement approach to eating, Americans tend to embrace the low-information diet, a concept first popularized by Tim Ferriss, in which you aggressively eliminate sources of news and information to help reclaim more time for other pursuits. This American approach to information is much like our approach to healthy eating, which focuses more on aggressively eliminating what's bad than celebrating what's good. There are merits to both approaches, but when it comes to navigating news and related information without becoming a slave to the attention economy conglomerates, I suspect the European focus on slowness is more likely to succeed in the long run. Embracing the slow media movement, therefore, is exactly what this practice suggests. The original Slow Media Manifesto addresses both producers and consumers of media. I want to focus here just on consumption, with a particular emphasis on the news, as this is an aspect of media consumption that makes us particularly vulnerable to attention exploitation. Many people now consume news by cycling through a set sequence of websites and social media feeds. If you're interested in politics, for example, and lean toward the left side of the political spectrum, this sequence might go from CNN.com to the New York Times homepage, to Politico, to The Atlantic, to your Twitter feed, and finally to your Facebook timeline. If you're into technology, Hacker News and Reddit might be in that list. If you're into sports, you'll include ESPN.com and team-specific fan pages, and so on. Crucial to this news consumption habit is the ritualistic nature of the sequence. You don't make a conscious decision about each of the sites and feeds you end up visiting. Instead, once the sequence is activated, it unfolds on autopilot. The slightest hint of boredom becomes a tripwire to activate this whole hulking Rube Goldberg apparatus. We're used to this behavior, so it's easy to forget that it's largely an artifact of the recent rise of the digital attention economy. These companies love your ritualistic checking, as each pass through your personal cycle deposits some more pennies in their bank account. Checking 10 different sites 10 times a day makes them money, even if it doesn't leave you more informed than checking one good site once a day. This behavior, in other words, is not a natural reaction to an increasingly connected age, but instead a lucrative tick bolstered by powerful economic pressures. Slow media offers a more palatable alternative. To embrace news media from a mindset of slowness requires first and foremost that you focus only on the highest quality sources. Breaking news, for example, is almost always much lower quality than the reporting that's possible once an event has occurred and journalists have had time to process it. A well-known journalist recently told me that following a breaking story on Twitter gives him the sense that he's receiving lots of information, but that in his experience, waiting until the next morning to read the article about the story in the Washington Post almost always leaves him more informed. Unless you're a breaking news reporter, it's usually counterproductive to expose yourself to the fire hose of incomplete, redundant, and often contradictory information that spews through the internet in response to noteworthy events. Vetted reporting, appearing in established newspapers and online magazines, tends to provide more quality than social media chatter and breaking news sites. Similarly, consider limiting your attention to the best of the best when it comes to selecting individual writers you follow. The internet is a democratizing platform in the sense that anyone can share their thoughts. This is laudable. But when it comes to reporting and commentary, you should constrain your attention to the small number of people who have proved to be world-class on the topics you care about. This doesn't necessarily mean that they have to write for a big established organization. A powerful voice expressing herself on a personal blog can be just as high quality as a longtime reporter for The Economist. But instead, that they've proved to you to be reliably smart and insightful with their writing. When an issue catches your attention, in other words, you're usually better served checking in on what the people you respect most think about it than wading into the murk of a Twitter hashtag search or the back-and-forth commenting littering your Facebook timeline. It's a general rule of slow movements that a small amount of high-quality offerings is usually superior to a larger amount of low-quality fare. Another tenet of slow news consumption? If you're interested in commentary on political and cultural issues, this experience is almost always enhanced by also seeking out the best arguments against your preferred position. I live in Washington, D.C., so I know professional political operatives on both sides of the aisle. A requirement of their job is that they keep up to speed on the best opposing arguments. A side effect of this requirement is that they tend to be much more interesting to chat with about politics. In private, they don't exhibit the same anxious urge to tilt at straw man versions of opposing viewpoints that's exhibited by most amateur political commenters, and instead are able to isolate the key underlying issues, or identify the interesting nuances that complicate the matter at hand. I suspect they derive much more pleasure out of consuming political commentary than those who merely seek confirmation that anyone who disagrees is deranged. As we've known since the time of Socrates, engaging with arguments provides a deep source of satisfaction independent of the actual content of the debate. Another important aspect of slow news consumption is the decisions you make regarding how and when this consumption occurs. The compulsive click cycle described earlier is the news equivalent of snacking on Doritos and is not compatible with the principles of the slow movement. I recommend instead isolating your news consumption to set times during the week. To foster the state of full concentration promoted by the Slow Media Manifesto, I further recommend that you ritualize this consumption by choosing a location that will support you in giving your full attention to the reading. I also recommend that you care about the particular format in which you do this reading. For example, perhaps you look through an old-fashioned paper newspaper each morning over breakfast. This brings you up to speed on the major stories and provides a more interesting mix of stories than what you would curate for yourself online. Then, on Saturday mornings, perhaps you check in on a carefully selected group of online news sites and columnists, bookmarking the articles you want to dive deeper into, before heading to a local coffee shop with your tablet to read through this week's worth of deeper articles and commentary. If you can download these articles in advance, allowing you to read them without the distractions offered by an internet connection, that's even better. Serious news consumers also tend to deploy browser plugins or aggregation tools that can present them with articles stripped clean of advertisements and clickbait. If you follow the aforementioned approach to news consumption, or something with a similar focus on slowness and quality, you will remain informed about current events and up to speed on big ideas in the spaces you care most about. But you will also accomplish this without sacrificing your time and emotional health to the frantic cycle of clicking that defines so many people's experience of the news. There are any number of other rules and rituals that can offer similar benefits. The key to embracing slow media is the general commitment to maximizing the quality of what you consume and the conditions under which you consume it. If you're serious about joining the attention resistance, you should be serious about these ideas when confronting how you interact with information on the internet. Practice. Dumb down your smartphone. Paul works for a mid-size industrial company in the United Kingdom. He's not a senior citizen. In fact, he's relatively young. I'm telling you this to underscore the unusual step Paul took in the fall of 2015, when he traded in his smartphone for a Doro Phone Easy, a basic clamshell flip phone with oversized buttons and a big font display, marketed mainly to elderly people. Interestingly, Paul later discovered that there's an underground movement of executives that use dumb phones like the Doro. They are, for the most part, in finance, typically hedge fund managers. It turns out that for people who move hundreds of millions of dollars in high-stakes trades every day, there's great advantage in shielding yourself from distracting market information that can bias your decisions and potentially cost you massive amounts of money. I asked Paul about the experience. "It's silly, I know, but the first few weeks felt rough," he told me. "I didn't know what to do with myself." But then came the benefits. One of the major positive changes was that he no longer felt like his attention was divided when he was with his wife and kids. I hadn't appreciated how distracted I had been around them. While at work, his productivity shot up. Meanwhile, after those rough initial few weeks, he felt the sense of boredom and jitteriness dissipate. "I feel less anxious. I hadn't realized how anxious I'd become." His wife told him that she was struck by how happy he now seems. When the technology executive Daniel Clough decided to dumb down his phone experience, he didn't trash his iPhone, but instead put it in the kitchen cupboard. He likes to use it when exercising so that he can listen to music and run his Nike Plus fitness tracking app. On most other occasions, however, he brings his Nokia 130, a sleeker version of the Doro that shares its simplicity. No camera, no apps, no web, only calls and text messages. Like Paul, it took Clough a week or so to overcome the urge to constantly check something, but he soon passed that hurdle. As he reports on his personal blog, "I feel so much better. I'm more present and my mind feels less cluttered." According to Clough, the main inconvenience he experiences about life without a smartphone is his inability to Google something on the go. "But how great I feel without a smartphone far outweighs that." Even The Verge, a reliable bastion of techno-boosterism, admitted the potential value of a return to simpler communication devices. Exhausted by the near-constant Twitter checking induced by the 2016 presidential election, reporter Vlad Savov wrote an article titled, "It's Time to Bring Back the Dumb Phone," in which he claims that a return to simpler phones is not as drastic a regression as you might think, or as it might have been a few years ago. His main argument is that tablets and laptops have become so lightweight and portable that there is no longer a need to try to cram productivity functionalities into increasingly powerful, and therefore increasingly distracting, smartphones. Phones can be used for calls and messages, and other portable devices can be used for everything else. Some people want both options, the ability to take a smartphone with them on some occasions, longer trips, or when they might need to use a particular app, and a non-distracting, simpler device on other occasions, but worry about the inconvenience of maintaining two different numbers. There's now a solution for this scenario as well, the tethered dumb phone. These products, which include, notably, a Kickstarter darling called the Light Phone, don't replace your existing smartphone, but instead extend it to a simpler form. Here's how it works. Let's say you have a Light Phone, which is an elegant slab of white plastic about the size of two or three stacked credit cards. This phone has a keypad and a small number display. And that's it. All it can do is receive and make telephone calls, about as far as you can get from a modern smartphone, while still technically counting as a communication device. Assume you're leaving the house to run some errands, and you want freedom from constant attacks on your attention. You activate your Light Phone through a few taps on your normal smartphone. At this point, any calls to your normal phone number will be forwarded to your Light Phone. If you call someone from it, the call will show up as coming from your normal smartphone number as well. When you're ready to put the Light Phone away, a few more taps turns off the forwarding. This is not a replacement for your smartphone, but instead an escape hatch that allows you to take long breaks from it. The creators of the Light Phone, Joe Hollier and Kai-Wei Tang, met inside a Google incubator, where they were encouraged to make software apps and taught about what makes these products desirable to funders. They were not impressed. Quickly, it became obvious that the last thing the world needed was another app, they write on their website. Light was born as an alternative to the tech monopolies that are fighting more and more aggressively for our attention. Just in case their intentions as members of the attention resistance were not clear enough, Hollier and Tang posted a manifesto that opens with a diagram that reads, "Your clock symbol equals their money symbol." In my earlier chapter on solitude, I suggested that you reject the mindset that says you must always have your smartphone with you. The hope was to create more occasions for solitude, which we as humans need to thrive. The examples discussed here go much further, as they suggest the possibility of acquiring an alternative communication device that allows you to spend most, if not all, of your time free from a smartphone. Declaring freedom from your smartphone is probably the most serious step you can take toward embracing the attention resistance. This follows because smartphones are the preferred Trojan horse of the digital attention economy. As discussed at the opening of this chapter, it was the spread of these always-on interactive billboards that allowed this niche sector to expand to the point that they now enjoy as dominant players in the worldwide economy. Given this reality, if you're not carrying a smartphone, you fall off the radar of these organizations, and as a result, you'll find your efforts to reclaim your attention significantly simplified. Dumbing down your phone, of course, is a big decision. Our attraction to these devices goes well beyond their ability to provide distraction. For many, they provide a safety net for modern life, protection against being lost, feeling alone, or missing out on something better. Convincing yourself that a dumb phone can satisfy enough of these needs so that its benefits outweigh its costs is not necessarily easy. Indeed, it might require a leap of faith, a commitment to test life without a smartphone to see what it's really like. For others, this practice may remain too extreme. Some people are tied to their smartphones for specific reasons that cannot be ignored. If you're a healthcare worker who makes home visits, for example, maintaining access to Google Maps is key. Similarly, around the time I was writing this chapter, I received a note from a reader from Curitiba, Brazil, noting that the ability to use ride-sharing services like Uber and 99 is crucial to getting around in a city where cabs and walking are often not available options. For other people, the opposite issue might hold. Their smartphones aren't enough of a problem for them to receive much benefit from removing them from their life. I count myself in this category. I don't have any social media accounts, I don't play mobile games, I'm terrible about texting, and I already spend long times away from my phone each day. I could turn in my used iPhone for a Nokia 130, but I don't think it would make much difference. On the other hand, If you're someone who could conceivably get away without ubiquitous smartphone access, and if your gut is telling you that this might make your life much better, then you should be reassured that this decision is no longer as radical as it might have once seemed. The dumb phone movement is gathering steam, and the tools available to support this lifestyle change are improving. If you're exhausted by your smartphone addiction, it's not only possible to say no more, it's actually not that hard. Remember how Hollier and Tang opened their manifesto with the idea, your time equals their money. You should feel empowered to instead invest this value in things that matter more to you. Conclusion. In the fall of 1832, a French packet ship named Sully left Le Havre en route to New York. On board was a 41-year-old painter, traveling home from a European tour in which his work had failed to generate much notice. His name was Samuel Morse. As the historian Simon Winchester recounts, it was on this journey, somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic, that Morse experienced the epiphany that would help him change the world. The catalyst for this moment was a fellow passenger, Charles Jackson, a Harvard geologist who happened to be up to date on recent discoveries in the study of electricity. As the two men discussed potential uses for this new medium, they stumbled across a remarkable insight. As Morse recalls thinking, "If the presence of electricity can be made visible in any part of the circuit, I see no reason why intelligence may not be transmitted by electricity." In Winchester's telling, this was a vatic revelation for the failed painter, who immediately understood the possibilities of electronic communication. On arrival in New York, he rushed to his studios to begin the long process of experimentation needed to make practical the deceptively simple idea hatched on the Sully. 12 frenetic years later, in May of 1844, Morse set up his telegraph key on a table in the chamber of the United States Supreme Court, where he was surrounded by a small group of influential legislators and government officials. An electrical wire, augmented on regular intervals with signal-boosting relays, connected Morse to his associate and fellow inventor Alfred Vail, who was stationed 40 miles away in a railway station outside of Baltimore. It was time for Morse to make his first major demonstration of his invention. All he needed was an inaugural message. Based on a suggestion from the daughter of the patent commissioner who had supported Morse's innovation, he tapped a well-known phrase from the end of the Book of Numbers. "What hath God wrought?" As Winchester notes, these words, when considered in isolation, formed a simple declarative exclamation, a statement of Samuel Morse's faith. But in the context of the transformation this invention and its successors would spark, it was better understood as a suitably portentous epigraph for an era of change that now commenced with unimagined speed and unimaginable consequences. Humans have been improving their world with invention since before the beginning of recorded history. But there's something about the innovations driving electronic communication that make them, as Winchester writes, so mystifyingly different from what had gone before. Mechanical wonders fit the physical understanding of the world etched into our brains through millions of years of evolution. A charging steam locomotive might be awe-inspiring, but it also fundamentally makes sense. Fire creates steam that pushes the train's pistons forward. A telegraph message or phone call or email or social media ping is somehow different. We lack an intuition for flowing electricity and the complex components that control it, and the concept of back-and-forth conversation existing outside the context of two people talking in close proximity is completely foreign to our species' history. The result is that we've always struggled to imagine the consequences of the electronic communication revolution started by Samuel Morse, and often find ourselves scrambling to make ex post facto sense of its impacts on our world. As noted in an earlier chapter, Henry David Thoreau's reaction to the telegraph boom that followed Morse's 1844 demonstration was to remark that we're so eager to build a line between Maine and Texas that we never stopped to ask why these two states needed to be connected in the first place. Though dated in its particulars, this same sentiment applies well to our current age of social media and smartphones. First Facebook, then the iPhone. Compulsive communicating and connecting, supported by mysterious, almost magical innovations in radio modulation and fiber optic routing, swept our culture before anyone had the presence of mind to step back and re-ask Thoreau's fundamental question. To what end? The result is a society left reeling by unintended consequences. We eagerly signed up for what Silicon Valley was selling, but soon realized that in doing so we were accidentally degrading our humanity. It's in this long-term trajectory that we can place digital minimalism. This philosophy is meant to be a human bulwark against the foreign artificiality of electronic communication, a way to take advantage of the wonders that these innovations do in fact provide. Maine and Texas, it turns out, did have some useful things to say once connected, without allowing their mysterious nature to subvert our human urge to build a meaningful and satisfying life. This history places digital minimalism in a somewhat grandiose position, but as we explored in the preceding chapters, implementing this philosophy is largely an exercise in pragmatism. Digital minimalists see new technologies as tools to be used to support things they deeply value, not as sources of value themselves. They don't accept the idea that offering some small benefit is justification for allowing an attention-gobbling service into their lives, and are instead interested in applying new technology in highly selective and intentional ways that yield big wins. Just as important, they're comfortable missing out on everything else. At the same time, I want to emphasize that transitioning to this lifestyle can be demanding. Many of the minimalists I interviewed balance their tales of triumph with examples where they let a tool get the best of them. This is fine. Adopting digital minimalism is not a one-time process that completes the day after your digital declutter. It instead requires ongoing adjustments. In my experience, the key to sustained success with this philosophy is accepting that it's not really about technology, but is instead more about the quality of your life. The more you experiment with the ideas and practices, the more you'll come to realize that digital minimalism is much more than a set of rules. It's about cultivating a life worth living in our current age of alluring devices. Those who are committed to the digital status quo might attempt to cast this philosophy as somehow anti-technology. I hope I've convinced you in this book that this claim is misguided. Digital minimalism definitively does not reject the innovations of the internet age, but instead rejects the way so many people currently engage with these tools. As a computer scientist, I make a living helping to advance the cutting edge of the digital world. Like many in my field, I'm enthralled by the possibilities of our techno future. But I'm also convinced that we cannot unlock this potential until we put in the effort required to take control of our own digital lives, to confidently decide for ourselves what tools we want to use, for what reasons, and under what conditions. This isn't reactionary, it's common sense. I opened this book with Andrew Sullivan's concern about losing his humanity in the electronic world wrought by Samuel Morse. "I used to be a human being," he wrote. My hope is that digital minimalism can help reverse this state of affairs by providing a constructive way to engage and leverage the latest innovations to your advantage, not that of faceless attention economy conglomerates, to create a culture where the technologically savvy can upend Sullivan's lament, and instead say with confidence, "Because of technology, I'm a better human being than I ever was before." This is Will Damron. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Digital Minimalism, on Living Better with Less Technology, by Cal Newport. This program was directed by Olivia Mackenzie Smith. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Text copyright 2019 by Calvin C. Newport. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.